This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So hello everyone, welcome back to the Disability Studies channel of the New Books Network. Today I feel very happy to invite Dr. Corinne McGeer to join us to introduce her newest book, Measuring Difference, Numbering Normal. So the first question today I want to ask is to invite Dr. McGeer to introduce herself to us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Corinne McGuire, and I'm an assistant professor at Durham University. And I think, like most people who work in disability history or disability studies, my interest in the topic really stemmed from personal experience. And when I was around 16 years old, I became very unwell and had to live as an inpatient in a hospital for quite a few months. This was a deeply transformative experience for me. It changed my career expectations. It changed my friendships and family relationships. It changed how I lived and the things I could do. It changed how I thought about myself, and it changed how I thought about the medical profession, especially because after receiving two separate diagnoses in the subsequent year, I realized that there was a huge disjuncture between these labels and my subjective lived experience. And I think that's probably why I first became interested in deaf history as an undergraduate. Especially some of the older work, like Harlan Lane's work and his article, Do Deaf People Have a Disability? I think I found the anger and the resistance in that kind of scholarship incredibly edifying and clarifying. And at the same time, I was taking sign language classes with my mum, who had started wearing hearing aids following an accident that resulted in hearing loss. And as I pursued my fourth year dissertation on how oralism, which is the practice of forcing deaf people to speak to the exclusion of sign languages, was followed in Scottish education, I became more deeply immersed in deaf history and disability studies. However, I also realised that my mum was really struggling with her sign language classes because she couldn't hear the teacher. And I realised that she wasn't really in the kinds of histories that I was reading. And I started wondering where people like her were. How could we find them? How do you find the people who do not identify as deaf as hearing and who actively hide their hearing loss? How do you recover the emotional journeys of those who experience hearing loss at a loss? How do we find the people that are not just hidden in history but have actively hidden themselves? So when Ian Hutchinson, another Scottish disability historian, sent me an email outlining a PhD scholarship designed to research hearing loss and its relationship to the telephone system, I realised that this was my chance to find out. So I moved to the University of Leeds in 2013 to work with Professor Graham Goody on his AHRC project on how hearing loss related to the British telephone system. And that work and my subsequent postdoctoral research with Javi Carell on the Wellcome-funded Life of Breath project at the University of Bristol formed the basis of my book.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer. Actually, initially I planned to ask a question following self-introduction question. I want to ask you why you take interest in study disability history. But of course, you certainly answered the question in your long answer earlier. But anyway, so now let's turn to your book. So for the book, my first question is that I want to invite you to discuss the philosophical implication of your historical analysis of measuring disability.
Yeah, thank you for asking me this question. I suppose I should say, first of all, that I've always worked across different disciplines. My undergraduate degree was in English Literature and History. My PhD was in History and Philosophy of Science. My postdoctoral work took place in a philosophy department, and I'm now working in Durham's History Department, but have one foot firmly planted in the Institute for Medical Humanities. So I think it's probably not surprising that the philosophical aspects of disability were really interesting to me. But actually, I think that metaphysical questions about what disability is and how we count it are really intrinsic to doing good disability history. And that's because what disability is for historians depends in part on the model of disability that they deploy. And this is the result of the debt that disability historians have to foundational disability studies texts that propounded a social model that conceptualized disability as the result of forced societal exclusion from the community and the labour market. And as it emerged in the late 1980s, the social model separated impairment from disability in a similar way to the sex gender formation propounded by second wave feminist scholars. By conceptualizing disability as the result of inaccessible structures, it positioned itself in opposition to a medical model which framed disability as the result of individual impairments that could be fixed, quote unquote, by medical or technical intervention. And so this means that, as historians like Julie Anderson, for instance, have long pointed out, an integrated investigation of medical technology using social model theory hasn't always been done. The social model really did create specific difficulties with integrating the history of medicine and disability history because of the implicit association between the study of medical things and the medical model. This is something Beth Linker pointed out in her off-cited 2013 positioning piece. She wrote that the separation between the two disciplines was in part fueled by disciplinary world-building. That is, quote, the desire among disability historians to define themselves as something other than medical historians. And this kind of separation of disability from medicine was further perpetuated by the force of the medical/social model binary, which maintained that studying medical places and devices was something that would just further perpetuate the medical model. But the problem there is that demarcating science, medicine, and their related histories as oppressive forces working in opposition to the social model has kind of prevented real engagement with how precisely science and medicine have worked to create disablement. This neat separation of disability from impairment means that the conception of impairment is reified as objective. And this split thus implicitly supports the legitimacy of a naturalist medical model. And as Amy Hamry has argued, we're missing, quote, a broader understanding of the epistemological status of knowledge claims about disability, because within disability studies following such approaches, power, particularly biopower rather than knowledge, has been the unifying focus. And as John Warner emphasized in 1995, most historians of medicine never shed a guarded leaning to biological realism. In fact, those most squeamish about recognising the material reality of disease have the greatest affinity to history of science. So we need to develop methodologies that are capable of analysing the medical model of disability as social. Although the design model, for instance, has brought welcome new attention to the importance of technologies, approaches pioneered within history of science and technology studies can reveal the disabling impacts of science itself and allow us to attend to disability in its broadest sense. And this is the approach that I tried to start in my book.
Thanks so much for answering. Yeah. So for the next question, I want to invite you to talk about how the telephone was utilized as a tool for the categorization of hearing through the British Post Office nationalized telephone system.
Okay. Well, first of all, I guess I would say that actually the telephone and hearing loss have always been linked. The telephone was originally conceived by Alexander Graham Bell to be a kind of hearing aid, but in fact it soon became a tool for people with normal hearing, so-called, to communicate with. But actually, to use the early telephone, you had to have higher than average levels of hearing abilities. It was very, very difficult to hear. We can see that from documents like advice sheets that the Post Office commissioned with guidance on how to correctly pronounce numbers and conduct a telephone conversation, meaning not just that people were told how to communicate with greatest clarity over the telephone line. It also meant that people were able to anticipate what it was they should be hearing. The telephone, it changed everything because it was the first time that sound was isolated from accompanying visual information. It was a purely oral device that served to further isolate people with limited hearing from key areas of everyday life. Hearing measurement and testing equipment further led to the social exclusion of those who did not measure up to the standardised levels of hearing set by the Post Office and its artificial ear. The artificial ear was used to test the quality of telephone transmissions, and the Post Office designed the artificial ear to functionally resemble a human ear, replicating the functions of the outer, middle and inner ear. But what's really interesting to me about this device is the data that was used to create it. That is 12 that it was gathered from. It was gathered from 12 normal male ears and 2 abnormal male ears. That's a quote again. And the 2 abnormal male ears were actually excluded from the data set. So the data gathered through tests on the 10 normal ears was used to provide the representative standard of normal hearing. And this was used to create this auditory standards to design normal telephones in Britain. So it's not an average, it's an ideal. That's what the normal hearing level was. And if users didn't have the ability to use the normal telephones, then it followed that they had to use the telephone service for the deaf. So the data that was fed into the telephone became the arbiter of a medical condition. And for those who fell outside of the limits of the artificial ears telephonic standards, the telephone service for the deaf was created. And this was an amplified telephone service that was used by the post office. And it categorised users' identity as either hearing, which meant they could use the standard telephone, hard of hearing, which meant they could use the telephone when amplified, or deaf, which meant they could not use the telephone even when amplified. And the key point here is that categorisation depended on the efficacy of the technology, not on the telephone user's level of hearing. And at the same time, clinicians are starting to use the telephone in the form of the audiometer to create standardised levels of normal hearing and define deviance from that as a deafness that could be corrected with appropriate hearing aids.
Thank you so much for saying it. So for a certain question, I'm wondering how the standard of normal hearing for telephone use failed to correlate with the experience of people with hearing loss in the interwar years.
Okay, so how did the standard of normal hearing fail to correlate with the experience of people with hearing loss in interwar years? Okay, so the categorizations that I just outlined, they didn't match at all with telephone users' lived experience and their self-assessment of hearing acuity. There are files and files and files in BT archives of complaints from people who demanded that the post office provide a telephone that they could hear, who were convinced that the problem was with the service and not with them. Many of these users took matters into their own hands and created devices and amplifying equipment that allowed them to hack and therefore hear their own telephones. But this was a huge problem for the post office, whose telephone service was nationalised between 1911 and 1981, meaning it was actually illegal to tamper with its equipment. So these user innovations forced the post office to develop their service in alignment with user intervention and innovation. And sometimes even, as I outlined the case of Raymond Harris, meant that they directly lifted the amplification designs that their subscribers had invented themselves.
And so much. So for the following question, I'm wondering about the initial use of spirometric data and then the development of relevant reference classes.
Okay, so as we just discussed, with hearing, there was a line of normalcy that pertained to all. It was normal hearing for everyone, it was just the same. But this was never the case with spirometry, in which the classes of normalcy were debated from the start. Who were the normal subjects? Was normal breathing universal, or did it vary between groups? What groups? And before getting into this topic, first I should say that spirometers were developed in the 19th century to measure the volume of air an individual could exhale and express this as a number. And this number indicated an individual's vital capacity. Now, these tests accounted for, nowadays, today, these tests do account for residual air in the lungs and they include a timed component. But initially, they simply were measuring lung volume by measuring individuals' exhalatory capacity to displace water in litres. So at that point, that's the first time you have this kind of discrete entity, lung capacity, that can be quantified and ranked and represented as vital capacity. And it was a man called John Hutchinson who coined the term spirometer, which literally translates in Latin as breath measurer, in 1844. And he came up with all these tables showing what ideal vital capacity should be for height after having collected data on over 4,000 test subjects, which he divided by variables including occupation and class. So his lists include categories like paupers, sailors, firemen, diseased cases, gentlemen, and pugilists. Pugilists are wrestlers. However, it didn't include women, who were considered by Hutchinson to be too difficult to measure. That's a common thing. still a common thing. Eventually, he did experiment on women, but he was unsure about whether their tendency to breed from the chest rather than the abdomen was due to their tendency to get pregnant and need space for gestation, or whether it was due to their tendency to wear corsets. At this point, I think it really gets at the heart of the issues around measurement that the book brings up, because women who breathe costly also became linked with higher racial purity, and soon race became a key reference class for spirometric measurement. This is something Lundy Braun has explored in depth in her brilliant book, Breathing Race into the Machine. And in this book, she shows that the use of racial correction factors have obscured and continue to obscure the environmental factors that caused diminished lung function. And in my book, I show that the same thing happened to miners in South Wales, who were measured in relation to other miners from the same colliery and assessed as normal for miners. And I think this is the main takeaway that I would want people to really get from the book, that measuring the body seems paradigmatic of objective scientific practice, but the decisions about what measurements we prioritise, the types of instruments we use to measure, and representative body types are heavily freighted with historical biases. Measurement requires data collection and categorisation, and the data collection behind measurement can be discriminatory, it can be incomplete, it can be misleading. But such measurement processes necessarily involve making meaningful comparisons between groups. For example, if we want to know whether a patient with hair loss is suffering from a disease, we need to know their age or their sex to ascertain whether baldness should be expected in this person as a member of the relevant group. Normal in middle-aged men, not for teenage girls. However, dividing people into categories for counting can lead to misattributions and mistakes in diagnosis. So for instance, measuring women and men separately can give rise to biological essentialism, whereby we attribute health effects to the condition of being a woman, gestation, rather than searching for causation in the society in which women live. Corsets. We tend to always go for biological essentialism over societal and environmental difference, for a lot of reasons. I think largely to do with how that links into the responsibility for change, and that the fact that if it is environmental, it can be changed. But this can give rise to the elevation of static sex differences over modifiable gender differences, such as those linked to societal treatments or understandings about how women should be and behave. And this really, what it does, it obscures the role of the environment, and it hides also the potential role of societal processes in shaping normal physiology. Conversely, failure to measure women separately to men can lead to failures in understandings of how particular treatments and diagnoses might manifest differently. So these historical topics are really relevant, really important. And as I've just shown, these kind of data gaps are also very prevalent in groups such as the disabled, who are often excluded from research studies. So measurements can therefore make difference visible and meaningful, but it can also hide and distort it, differences by obscuring the role of the environment in making these differences. So we need to measure, but we need to measure with care, with consideration of how measurement can make meaning.
Thanks so much for your answer. Again, so for our last one today, I'm wondering about how issues pertaining to experience of patients were utilized in the development of resuscitation technology.
Yeah, interesting question. So in my chapter on this, I compare two different resuscitation or artificial respiratory devices, breathing machines, as they were known by the Medical Research Council, and look at the iron lung. And I kind of place that in opposition to devices like the Bragg-Paul pulsator, because I suppose the iron lung was eventually manufactured in factories, it was standardized, it was placed in hospitals, and it was very much one size fits all. So it has a really different origin story from the Bragg-Paul pulsator, which was developed by William Bragg originally for his neighbor, Captain Samuel Hallahan, who had some kind of wasting disease, I think muscular dystrophy, which meant that he was required to be kind of manually inflated, literally, you know, by his wife and nurses at all times of the day, meaning that his wife couldn't do the inflation and talk to him because it was too exhausting, and she couldn't talk to him freely while the nurses were doing the job. So it really impacted their relationship. And William Bragg was round and kind of speaking to her and seeing this, and I think he saw a football in their garden and decided, hey, maybe that'll work. You know, he's kind of older at this time. He's an elder statesman in British scientific establishment. So he basically gets the football bladder, attaches it to a kind of hinged board, and creates this very basic pumping device, you know, that's attached to Samuel's chest and manually inflates it. It actually works really well. And what he does is he gets the instrument maker Robert Paul to come and help him and to make it more durable, more scientific, and more kind of practical. And it's an enormous success, and it's very much kind of something that's created with the needs of the user, including their social needs in mind. But eventually they also get a physiologist involved, a woman called Dr. Phyllis Kerridge, who I'm writing about in my next book with Dr. Jay Birdie. And what Kerridge does is she kind of makes the device standardized as and replicable. She makes it so that other people can use it, so that they can make more than one. They work with a kind of a diving company. I can't remember the name of the diving company, but they manufacture lots of these devices, and they make it so that they can be fitted to different body types, including babies. They end up saving an enormous amount of babies who need resuscitation when they're born. So that's a device that's kind of created with the user in mind, and it's modifiable and adjustable to different body types. So I kind of create this dichotomy between the one device that does take into account user experiences and the iron lung, which is very much one size fits all. And what I look at in quite a lot of detail is the Medical Research Council's report on breathing machines, where they try and decide, okay, so, I mean, polio was a huge issue in the 1930s in England, and they want to decide which machine they should say is the best machine to use. The Brad Paul is something that uses positive pressure because it's just manually inflating the lungs, whereas the iron lung works quite differently. That uses negative pressure and uses vacuum pressure, which is much more like the way that we breathe naturally. We're kind of under a sea of air and we're under negative pressure, and that's how our lungs work most of the time. And it's a fascinating report. Kerridge is involved in it, as well as many of the kind of leading physiologists and clinicians of the day. Edward Mellenby is the person who's leads on that report. And what you see a lot in especially the kind of appendix of the report is reports of people being put into the lung and fighting against it. And they have to kind of adjust their breathing with the machine rather than the other way around. So what's interesting then is that they kind of release the report just at the time that Lord Nuffield decides to donate all of these iron lungs that he makes in his car factory to the health services. And so it becomes standard practice to put people in lungs in the hospital rather than letting them use devices at home. And what I've started to explore now in an article, for instance, in Technology and Culture, which came out in January of this year, is the kind of long-lasting impacts of the lack of consideration of users' needs and the needs of their family. Because, you know, what eventually happens is that people fight back and they decide they don't want to live in the hospital. They want to live at home and work from home. And many people do so and live amazing lives with their families using these kinds of technologies, including iron lung. So in a way, that kind of dichotomy I drew between the iron lung and the Brad Paul pulsator doesn't really hold, because it's not actually, as I thought, so much an instance of kind of standardization versus non-standardization. The devices do different things. But certainly it's been fascinating to follow that story on, and hopefully interesting for people to see kind of what happened after 1939. So I hope people will read that too. It's a nice follow on to the book, I think.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer. So that's all questions I prepared for your talk today. So at the end of our episode today, I want to directly talk to the audience. So for my dear listeners, again, I want to say every time at the end of my episode, I always say that, but I want to say it again. I highly recommend that you consider buy a copy or just read and borrowing the copy of this book from the public library or any kind of library close and nearby you. I recommend you to read this book. I mean, the book is very fantastic. It's about it's about how disability today, our understanding, our comprehension of disability was shaped, was a result of social construct. So as you can see in the title of this book, of Dr. Corinne McGuire's book, Measuring Difference, Numbering Normal. So now we use number 1 to 10, for example, to understand, to describing, to define, to numbering disability, to numbering normal. Actually, the idea was not given, but it's historical. So after reading this book, you may further understanding how our current number-based understanding of disability was shaped by the power, was shaped by the production of scientific knowledge. So at the end of at the very end of our episode today, I want to repeat the title, because I hope you don't forget the title of this fantastic book. It's necessary for you if you want to buy a copy or borrowing a copy of this book. The title is Measuring Difference, Numbering Normal. And for anyone with any interest in either disability history or in history of social science or history of medical science, I personally recommend you to read this book, Measuring Difference, Measuring Difference, Numbering Normal, the fantastic book. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And I should also say it is open access, so you don't even have to buy it. You can read it online for free.
That's a good idea. Over time.
Yes, ideally, I want people to read it online and then buy it first, because they think it's so great.
Thank you so much.
We'll see.
Thanks for you. Yeah, it's free. So thank you.
Thanks, Shay.